ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Next month, the Supreme Court of New South Wales celebrates its 200th birthday. Of course, our country and our institutions are not perfect, but we are fortunate to have independent courts and a strong rule of law. The Bicentenary is an opportunity to reflect on the role of the courts in our nation's long, difficult and still ongoing journey towards justice and equality for all. Hi, Damien Carrick with you. The Chief Justice of New South Wales, Andrew Bell, joins us now on the Law Report from Gadigal Land for his first extensive media interview since assuming the role in 2022. Chief Justice Bell, to mark the Bicentenary, the Supreme Court is this week launching a beautiful book called Constant Guardian, Changing Times. Why that title? How is the court a constant guardian and what is it guarding?
Well, it's guarding the rule of law with all that that important phrase entails. So part of that, an important constitutional part of that, is a check on executive power within the proper limits of judicial review. That's always been an important feature of the court. It is also the guardian of people's common law rights and contractual rights to enforce contracts, to uphold contracts, and then also to apply legislation, enforce legislation, interpret legislation. Requires an independent body, the court, which commands the respect of the people and is a reliable source of expertise and integrity and impartiality to administer the law, to resolve disputes, whether they be in the criminal law, commercial law, private law, matrimonial law. Originally, the court had a vast jurisdiction over matrimonial causes, property disputes, insolvency. The whole gamut of the legal spectrum requires an independent judiciary, and the constancy of the role of the Supreme Court and indeed the other courts in the state and throughout the country is an important enduring theme of our democracy.
So cycling back to 200 years ago, what was justice like in New South Wales before the creation of the Supreme Court in 1824?
Well, in those very early days, it was purely a penal colony. There weren't free settlers of any moment, and so the nature of the disputes was necessarily confined. But the nature of the colony was changing fairly quickly. That was the time of Macquarie's reign. The role of emancipists had begun to emerge, so former convicts were entering into civic life, and there was an active debate in the colony about what rights, the extent of the rights emancipated people would have in the colony as well. By that time, there were free settlers who became known as the exclusives in contrast to the emancipists. But you began to have a nascent economy as the land was opened up, agriculture developed, other commercial activities developed, and with that came the need for a court which dispensed far more than military justice, a court which was able to deal with all other manner of civil and indeed criminal disputes.
The early days of the colony, of course, were extremely violent. There were many massacres of Indigenous people. Generally speaking, how did the courts respond to massacres of Indigenous people by white settlers, white colonisers?
There was a real difficulty because to give evidence in a case, a witness would have to swear an oath and had to have a belief in a Christian God, which precluded Aboriginals giving evidence. But turning more directly to your question, in terms of massacres and the general context of society at that time, in 1824, the same year that the court was established, Governor Brisbane declared martial law, state of martial law, in and around the area we now know as Bathurst against the Wiradjuri people, and that effectively immunised settlers from the force and operation of criminal law for so long as martial law was declared. But perhaps the most striking case in terms of the court's legal history related to what's come to be known as the Mile Creek Massacre. And
for those who don't know, Mile Creek is about 250k inland from Coffs Harbour. And there was one colonial figure, John Hubert Plunkett, who did use the courts and did use the legal system to put a line in the sand. Tell me about that massacre in the 1830s and about that man.
So what happened was there was a group of Aboriginals who were living peacefully on a property owned by a settler and with harmonious and good relations with the owner of the property. He went away, whether to Sydney or he was away from the property. And while he was away, some stockmen came onto the property and essentially rounded up the Aboriginal people. And there was a massacre of, it's thought, 28, mainly women and children, on the grounds of the property. Now, news of this massacre came back to Sydney, and the then Attorney General was this extraordinary man called John Hubert Plunkett, who was an Irishman. In his capacity as Attorney General, he was also the Crown Prosecutor. Anyhow, a number of the stockmen were charged with this massacre, these murders in cold blood. The first trial resulted in an acquittal by a jury within 15 minutes. So badly massacred and burnt were the bodies that there was a problem with identification of the victims. And that problem with identification was exploited by the defence counsel, but it was an extraordinary verdict of acquittal within 15 minutes. Plunkett stood his ground. He brought additional charges, not in respect of the same person who'd been named in the indictment, but on behalf of another group of people who had been murdered. And he faced great calumny in the press and in the community. What was he doing? Why was he defending the natives, as they were called? How dare he call into question the integrity of the stockmen, etc. He was a very courageous advocate. He stood his ground. He prosecuted again. And this time, a jury, I should say that the second jury was subject to great intimidation, great public intimidation. So 48 members of the community were summoned for jury duty. Only 28 turned up because the other 20 had been effectively scared off, intimidated off, and even the remaining 28 who turned up were the subject of attempted intimidation. In any event, that second jury convicted in relation to 5 of the counts, and the men convicted were sentenced to death and indeed were executed. It was a trial which attracted great notoriety, put enormous pressure on Plunkett, but he stood his ground in the finest tradition of some of the great advocates in history.
All 7 were found guilty and all 7 were hanged.
Yeah.
Were Indigenous witnesses able to give evidence at this trial and at others?
No, that was the difficulty. For the reasons I earlier explained, to give evidence in a court, they had to swear an oath. To swear an oath, one had to have a Christian belief, and that was not possible or not able to be established. Plunkett nonetheless secured those particular convictions, but what he did subsequent to the trial through his position as Attorney General was attempt, and he did this over a number of years, unsuccessfully, but he attempted to have legislation passed which would allow Aboriginals to give evidence in court proceedings. And so you can imagine in some of these murder or massacre scenarios, the only surviving witness might have been an Aboriginal who had witnessed the events but had escaped. But he or she was the only person who was capable of giving key evidence. Now, in the Mile Creek massacre, there was a local station hand, a non-Indigenous, who was able to give critical evidence in the case, and he was very courageous too. But Plunkett took up this issue. Plunkett was a man of deep conviction.
The Mile Creek massacre trial, a very important step forward, but what was its impact? Did it stop the massacres, or did the murderers simply learn to hide their crimes?
Well, I mean, that's a massive study. We know that the mistreatment continued, that killings continued, etc. But it was a powerful sign that some, at least in the community, were prepared to stand up. Although we are conscious of great mistreatment of Indigenous people over the years throughout the country, there have been lawyers, and there, fortunately, increasingly, are more and more lawyers who are astute to systemic mistreatment and, in those cases, terrible murders.
Mm. You're listening to The Law Report, and today my guest is the Chief Justice of New South Wales, Andrew Bell, and we're discussing the bicentennial of the New South Wales Supreme Court. Chief Justice, the book Constant Guardian, Changing Times discusses many of the most significant decisions of the court, like the Mile Creek massacre trials, that require all of us to look very directly and squarely at our difficult history and atrocities committed against Indigenous people. On a lighter note, the book also recounts some of the most extraordinary and fantastical trials that have almost a film-like quality to them. For those outside Sydney, can you tell us about the Shark Arm murder of 1935?
It was a case which at the time was described as the most extraordinary criminal case in the world. That might have been a little bit of hyperbole, but possibly not. So in Sydney, there's a famous beach, Coogee Beach, where there was an aquarium, and there was a tiger shark which was captured and put into the aquarium, and the aquarium was there for public viewing, etc. On Anzac Day 1935, after the shark had been in the aquarium for about a week, it disgorged a human arm. The human arm had been severed. It hadn't been bitten by the shark. It had, on examination, clearly been severed from a body. The arm, which was otherwise largely intact, had just below the elbow a tattoo of two men boxing. Anyhow, the tattoo enabled police to further their investigations, and they ascertained fairly quickly that the arm which the shark had disgorged belonged to a man named James Smith. That led to further investigations, and in due course, a man named Brady.
Patrick Brady.
Yeah, was arrested, and a witness came forward called Holmes, who was a key witness for the Crown, who claimed that Brady had confessed to him. Now, before the trial came on, the coroner had gone about investigating the cause of the death. Brady's counsel were concerned that this would be hugely prejudicial to him in his trial, and so they brought proceedings, initially applied to the coroner, but subsequently to the Supreme Court, to argue that the coroner had no jurisdiction, because for the coroner to have jurisdiction, it was said there had to be a body. And in this case, there was no body, only an arm. Now, that argument actually ultimately succeeded, and succeed initially before the coroner, but succeeded in the Supreme Court. So the coronial inquiry was stayed, which had the happy consequence for Brady that at least the prejudicial reporting of this sensational case was not able to continue. But he still faced the difficulty that the man Holmes, who had given evidence that Brady had confessed to him, was going to be the key witness in the trial. But unfortunately, Mr. Holmes was murdered, shot three times before the trial commenced. That then, of course, led to further frenzy amongst the press, etc.
When the murder trial went ahead, what was the prosecution case? Because Reginald Holmes, the star witness, was now dead. He'd been shot three times in his car in the rocks.
He was dead. Well, there was some hearsay evidence which was rejected, that was from his wife, Mrs. Holmes, but also there was an attempt to argue that Brady had admitted the crime. Now, the argument was this: the police had read out Holmes's statement to Brady, to which Brady was said to have responded, "Oh, that's all right, if that's all he said." And so the argument was that that was an admission or a confession of his guilt. The Chief Justice, Sir Frederick Jordan, who presided at the trial, rejected that evidence or the assertion that that was an admission, and there was very little other evidence which implicated Brady, and accordingly he was acquitted and the charges against him were dismissed.
It's a fantastic rip-roaring story. Nobody is ever found guilty of the murder.
No.
But does it also speak to the checks and balances in our trial system? What is and isn't admissible evidence? What do you see as the kind of the significance over and above the amazing fact and yarn quality of this case?
Well, it does illustrate this, which we see continually throughout the court's history. Court cases and criminal matters aren't decided in the press. They're not decided by reporting. Often, as you know, reporting on particularly lurid cases is sensational. But the actual facts of a trial and the rules of evidence are designed to ensure reliability in the material which is admitted for the purposes of testing somebody's guilt or innocence. So all of our laws of evidence, which are faithfully applied by judges every day in the Supreme Court and District Court and local court, are designed with a view to ensuring that only safe and reliable evidence is permitted to be received by the court. And so the hearsay evidence is generally excluded. There are some exceptions to that. Of course, evidence which has been extracted under circumstances of oppression or extracted by induced by deceit, etc., will generally be excluded. And this is what judges do every day of the week in hearing charges. Bearing in mind, obviously, the consequences of criminal guilt are severe. Sending anyone to prison is obviously deprives them of their liberty, and you know, the statute book says that that's what must happen if somebody has committed offences. That's right and proper, but the courts ensure that the evidence used to convict people is reliable insofar as that can be assessed. And so that's a classic case where Brady was not able to be convicted because there was not adequate evidence to do so.
And we'll never know if he did it or not, perhaps. But
he would have been hung at the time. Don't forget, we had capital punishment in this country for a long, long time, and execution followed a murder conviction for about 150 years of our history. So you need to get it right, or you need to, even if you can't ensure perfection, which of course you can't, you need to ensure that the evidence that is being urged upon a jury to convict someone meets certain minimum safeguards.
So we're talking here about the role of the courts in upholding individual rights and individual rights in criminal trials, but also the rights of victims and for prosecution of their trials. We've been talking about the central role of the courts in delivering justice and accountability and ensuring checks and balances and in its constitutional role. In the 1980s, there was a focus on how to deal with complaints against judges to ensure their accountability, to ensure the accountability in the courts. And since 1986, New South Wales has had what is known as the Judicial Commission. Its birth was very difficult. It was a tussle between the then Attorney General Sheehan, I think his name was, and Sir Lawrence Street, the Chief Justice at the time. And, you know, that the Chief Justice at the time became embroiled in the politics and the political agendas of the time. Tell me about that tussle and why it was so extraordinary.
It was extraordinary because the debate about whether or not there should be a judicial commission and what its role would be was played out very publicly, that's to say in the newspapers and no doubt on television as well. The judiciary, including very senior members of the Supreme Court as well as Sir Lawrence Street, saw the proposed establishment of a judicial commission as an invasion of or an intrusion upon the independence of the courts. Courts value their independence for the reasons we've already discussed. An independent court acts as a court of review of the legality of legislation, the constitutionality, the validity of legislation. So to establish a body which could, in a sense, sit on top of the judiciary, not be part of the judiciary, but the creature of the executive insofar as the executive appoints members to it, was seen as a potentially really significant threat to the independence of courts. Initially, it was conceived as a body which could itself just recommend the dismissal of judges, of certain judges. And of course, judges used to be life tenure, but tenure now up until a certain age. And that was the policy issue which really strongly animated the opposition to the proposed creation of the Judicial Commission. On the other hand, Sheehan thought that you can have badly behaving judges. Judges should have a measure of accountability. And how was that to be effected? So there was vigorous debate. Street accused Sheehan of secrecy, of withholding the details of what was planned, and there was a great deal of suspicion about that. And indeed, Street became political in the sense of publicly expressing his concerns about what the government of the day was doing. Now, that is an unusual stance for a judge or a head of jurisdiction to take. But the subject matter of his interventions went to the heart or the core of the court or the role of the courts and their independence. The happy outcome, though, was that some compromises were reached, steps were taken to amend the proposed bill or the proposed model to only permit removal of a judge, after a conduct division of the commission had had a hearing and recommended to Parliament that there were grounds for the removal of a judge and both houses of the Parliament would have to act to so remove a judge.
So that system came into being, and although it was initially very controversial, I think it's fair to say that it's fairly well regarded around the country now
The Judicial Commission model is extremely well regarded.
And indeed, not long after the creation of the Judicial Commission, it was used when the courts had to deal with the inability of a Supreme Court Justice Vince Bruce to deliver judgments in an acceptable time frame. Basically, was, you know, he was procrastinating and I think suffering from depression. But a complaint was made to the Judicial Commission. It went before, I think, the upper house for a vote on whether he should be removed. Yep. What happened at that point, briefly?
Well, he addressed the Legislative Council, and in the book of the history, there's a very striking picture of a judge, in a sense, defending himself before the Parliament. As a judge, as you say, there were legitimate complaints about his discharge of his responsibility. In the event the upper house voted not to remove him from office, some considered his failings weren't serious enough, others wanted stronger evidence, and there was a practical concern about the need to run new trials from his reserved judgment. He resigned from the court the following year, but that's the closest a judge has come to being actually removed from office under the Judicial Commission.
So the Judicial Commission is, I guess, an idea again of the checks and balances, the separation of the powers, and striking that right balance to make sure that we have accountable government in all its arms.
Yep.
Coming back to the big picture,
yep,
as New South Wales celebrates the bicentennial of the Supreme Court, what sorts of conversations do you want us all to be having?
The first point I make is this, that it's not a celebration for celebration's sake. It provides an opportunity to put a focus on what I regard, and I would hope most people would regard, as an essential civic institution in our society. That's the first point. And we seek to put that focus on the civic institution at a time when many people believe that some civic institutions are losing respect, are losing support in the community, or are otherwise being degraded or downgraded. So part of my philosophy in celebrating the bicentenary is to focus light on the role that the court plays, the importance of that role, the longevity of that role, the constancy of that role, and the integrity of the judges who, the independent judges who make up the institution from time to time. So many of the activities, including the book surrounding the celebration of the bicentenary, are directed to that end, because it's an end which I think is intrinsically important.
Andrew Bell, Chief Justice of New South Wales since 2022. Thank you. Thank you for speaking to the Law Report. It's been a great pleasure, and thank you for coming into the ABC studio. It's been wonderful to have you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's all we have time for today. A big thank you to producer Christina Cucoglia and to sound engineer Carey Dell. You can follow The Law Report on the ABC Listen app. And if you find us on any other podcast platforms, please do leave a review, a like, a star rating, a thumbs up, whatever helps others find the program. I'm Damien Carrick. Until next time.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.